back at it with another edition of PXPcast. We are joined today by Stan Cotton of the Wake Forest Demon Deacons. But before we get into that, this, of course, is the podcast about play-by-play broadcasters for play-by-play broadcasters and hosted by a play-by-play broadcaster, a professional development pod that dives into the tips, tricks, experience, stories, process, and preparations of some of the biggest and best play-by-play announcers in the business. And as we talk to Stan Cotton today, your journey has been a meteoric rise that got you to Wake Forest, because you went to college while you were still in college, became the voice of a D2 school, were there for a decade, climbed the ranks to what people I think would call a mid-major school, although Marshall's a pretty big name, and then you wind up at Wake Forest. Broad way to start things off, but when you take a look back and you kind of assess the journey and the path for you, what was that climb like, and what was it like for you really kind of digging your feet in at every stop along the way? And it doesn't feel like you ever, nothing felt like a stepping stone. It felt like you established yourself and then the next opportunity came along.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Joel. And I'm glad you kind of picked up on that, because as I've talked to younger people over the years, one thing I've tried to tell them is, look, you know, your career, hopefully your career will span years and years and years and years. And I think too many young people want to start at the very top. And that's, you know, for some, they do get that opportunity very early in their career. For some, I think for most people, you know, it's a process. It really is a journey. I did Carson Newman games. It's about 30 minutes outside of Knoxville. At the time when I was there, it was an NAIA school. Now it's a Division II school. But I did their games for 12 years and loved every minute of it, because I loved what I was doing. And the most important thing to me at that time, and it still is today, is the game. It wasn't about me. It was about the players primarily and the coaches who coach those players. And then, you know, it was the game. And I just, Carson Newman was a really, really good football school, still is, but at my time there, they won 5 national titles in football, and they were a really, really good basketball program as well. Went to the NAIA national tournament in Kansas City a number of times. But so I wasn't looking for that next thing. I was just kind of enjoying being at Carson Newman. It was close to home. My home was Knoxville, Tennessee, and the head football coach had been my high school football coach. And we had connected very early in his career at Farragut High School, right outside of Knoxville. And we connected on a personal level. He stood up with me at my wedding. And he was at Carson Newman for a long, long time, won a ton of games, and passed away a few years ago. But he was the one that really kind of got me into the business. And that's a completely different story. But I was there at Carson Newman. I loved the people that I was working with. And then one day, just kind of, it was like, okay, been here for a long time. What might be that next step? And it ended up being Marshall. And I was at Marshall for 4 years and loved every minute of that. And I could still be at Marshall. I could still be at Carson Newman for that matter and be fine with that. But did get the opportunity after 4 years at Marshall to come to Wake Forest in the ACC, and have been here for 28 years. So I just, along the way, have been content in where I was, trying to work hard, trying to improve as a broadcaster, and just enjoy the moment, and not try to look too far ahead. And I think maybe some younger guys, and gals now, and it's great that a lot of women now are more and more women are in our business. But I just think they wanted to go somewhere too quickly. That's hopefully something that's a mistake. I've made several over the years, but that was a mistake I think I didn't make. And it's just, I don't know. I think it's made each stop that more meaningful. And I look back at my days at Carson Newman, my days at Marshall with great fondness. And I think, yeah, I've been really fulfilled here in Winston-Salem as well at Wake Forest. So that's kind of been the way I've looked at it. And it's been, you know, the way I've worked my way through those stops.
So you were 31 then, maybe 31, 32 when you left Carson Newman?
Yeah, that was the summer of 92. I would have been 31 years old. Yeah, yeah.
What was like, where did you take the satisfaction in, like, to your point? I think a lot of people, especially nowadays, would look at it and say like, oh, well, like, where am I going now? What's the next step? Where I got to keep moving forward. What is the thing that kept you most satiated professionally, being in it at Carson Newman, and maybe being the voice of that community, and the things that kept driving you forward day in and day out that allowed you to then kind of put your nose to the grindstone and kind of worry about the little things and getting better every day and eventually setting yourself up for what would be the right step when it presented itself?
Yeah, I wouldn't be truthful if I didn't say that a lot of the pull for me at Carson Newman was emotional and personal because of that relationship with Ken Sparks. Again, I was 30 minutes from my home in Knoxville, and I actually still, all of my years at Carson Newman, and I did some other things other than just the play-by-play there. I was a sports director at a television station in Knoxville for a few years. Also the sports director at the Vol Network's flagship station, WIVK Radio, for a few years, all the while doing Carson Newman games. So I actually lived in Knoxville. And when I did Carson Newman games, it's a half an hour, 45 minutes. So it's no big deal. It's like driving. I lived in Dallas for a few years. It's like driving across Dallas County, you know, and I know you're in Boston, and anywhere you go, it takes 30, 45 minutes, right, if you're in your car. So, but for me, it was an emotional attachment. I don't think there's any question. Plus, again, Carson Newman was so good in football. It was a pretty cool deal to call national championships every other year, you know, and I don't care that it was at the NAIA and not in Division I. It was Carson Newman had good football players. They were well coached, and they played good teams. So the South Atlantic Conference was and still is a really good athletic league. And so again, it was just that emotional tie for me of personal relationships, and then that being that close to home. That's what kept me there. But still, all the while, I wanted to improve. I wanted to be a pro about it. I wanted to do the best job that I could. We were very serious about it there. Ken Sparks was very serious about his program, and Carson Newman was serious about its entire athletic program, and still is to this day. So it was important to them, and it was important to me all those years.
Yeah, and the guy that's been the voice of the, you know, Carson Newman now has been there for well over a decade. Shouts to Adam, who has flourished in that role. I want to talk about personal relationships a little bit, though, because I know one of the guys that was a big influence for you in broadcasting was somebody that used to hit golf balls into their yard. Is that true?
Well, John Ward, the longtime voice of the Tennessee Volunteers, I lived in the same neighborhood that he did. I was about 13 when we moved in. It was a golf course community, and his house was off the first fairway. And I was a left-handed golfer, still am. And so my little slice used to land in John's yard a lot. And of course, as a kid, if you were a Tennessee fan, and what kid isn't who lives in Tennessee, we all knew who John Ward was. He was this iconic figure, an incredible celebrity in Tennessee. And of course, I felt pretty cool that he lived in my neighborhood. And every time, again, I'd hit my ball over there, and sometimes John would be out in his yard messing around. And so I got to interact with him a few times over, you know, looking for golf balls. And that was as a kid. And then later on, when I got into the media, it was a different kind of relationship with him. John was never a mentor of mine. I mean, I never worked with him or for him, but he became a friend and was very supportive of me in the early days of my career. And once I got into the business, was able to look back on all those years that I listened to John, not knowing that that was in a way kind of an early preparation for me. I've never really tried to copy John, although a lot of the things that I do and the way I phrase things when I go back and listen to them kind of sound like him, not because I'm trying to do that on purpose. It's just that's all I knew, right? And he was such a force back in those days when you were a fan of Tennessee and you listened to those games. That's just that's basically all I knew. And so once I started, that was kind of the starting point. You know, we lost him a few years ago, but I still look back on those days, and I can't imagine now that I'm in that business having a better role model, if you will, to look at and to pattern yourself after, at least from a foundational perspective, than John Ward. Back in the days when radio was much more important than it might be today, because there certainly was not the amount of television that there is now. But he was one of the giants of the business, and growing up in his neighborhood was pretty cool. It really, really was.
What made him a giant to you when you looked at him professionally? Like, what was his gold standard that stood out to you as you started calling games?
Well, he was just a great storyteller. He's really smart. His background was in advertising. He went to law school. He was a lawyer. I don't think he practiced, but he was just a smart guy. And language to him was very, very important. And he had this way of describing an event that just made it almost bigger than life. And I went to an awful lot of Tennessee games as a kid, but I can't remember. It was years before I missed even a home game. But the road games, you know, back in those days, every now and then one would be on television, but the rest, if you wanted to follow along, you listened to the radio. And so just year after year, week after week, listening to John Ward on the radio, just the way he described the big moments in Tennessee football and basketball history, just became part of your DNA. If you were a Tennessee fan, you could recall his big calls and the big moments for Tennessee. And so he was bigger than life. He really, really was. And to so many of us who were my age, he was Tennessee football. He was Tennessee basketball, because he was your link to the Vols when you couldn't be there. Again, once I got into the business, looking back on all those years of listening to him really did help prepare me for my career, which, and again, I can't imagine having anyone better than John Ward to start your foundation with.
In your opinion, jumping off of that, what makes great storytelling on radio in particular? People think so much now in terms of television or live streaming, but when you've got very limited time, most of the time on radio, how do you best tell stories?
Well, I think you have to know your subject matter. Right. You have to do your homework. And there's a lot of ways to go about doing that. I mean, we all have the internet, and we can do research and read what other people write. And I do a lot of that. But you can just be around the players and the coaches. You can go to practice, which I do as much as I can. You can watch your own team. Right. You can be around your coaches. You can take advantage of non-official moments like a press conference or whatever. You can be traveling with your team and, spend an hour with the coach over a cup of coffee, just talking about life and in the same way with players. And so you can use that type of information. Of course, you have to be careful of what you can and can't use on the air that comes from just a very casual conversation. But again, if you've been there long enough, you know what that line is, and you build a trust with that coach or with that player. And so you do all of that. And so you know your subject matter, and you use that as probably your base. And then you take all the information that we have available to us now, the stats and all those types of things. And you weave those things together, with as much detail as you can. You know, and I think that's lost on some people now, because, you know, so many games are on television. And I know that a lot of people will watch Wake Forest games and turn the television sound down and listen to us. But I still think I have to, and we as a broadcast team have to attack what we do as if we were broadcasting to those who cannot see what's going on. And so that requires a lot of detail. And when you're on the air for 3, 4, 5 hours, that's a lot of detail. And the more foundation you have from knowing things about your coaches, knowing things about your players, you can use that to weave into what's going on during the game to tell the story. The most important thing is, again, as I said at the start, is the game itself. That's why, you know, people are tuning in to your broadcast. They want to follow their team. So the game is the most important thing to your listeners. So it needs to be the most important thing, the broadcaster. And then you can salt and pepper it with some of the other things that I've talked about. And hopefully what comes out in the end is the story of that game told from the perspective of someone who knows that team better than anybody else, better than a television announcer. And that's just the nature of the beast. I mean, the television crews, they come in for a short amount of time, bam, they do the game, they're gone, they're on to the next one. That's the nature of their business. And so they can't possibly know what you do about your own team. And so that's kind of the way that I look at it and try to do each game.
We talked with Neil Price on our recent episode about what goes on his boards. And he doesn't put a ton statistically on them. So when you talk about all of that information that you gather as the radio voice of a team, how much of that winds up in front of you on paper every single night? Or how do you best categorize what winds up in front of you so that it's useful?
Yeah, that's a process that never stops. I mean, that is something that I refine game after game after game. I go back and listen to not all, but mostly all of our broadcasts just as I get ready for the next game. I've got the past game on, just listening to it and comparing what I'm saying with what I have on my boards. And I'm kind of like Neil, and I think he's got that. I mean, you can, you know, when you're on television and you can represent stats with a graphic and the consumer can look at that and really soak that up. Sometimes numbers, if you throw too many at a listener, you're driving down the road in his pickup truck, sometimes the numbers are hard for him or her to digest. So you have to have some numbers, obviously, but too many is a bad thing. And so you mix in with that some of the, hey, I was at practice the other day and saw this or whatever. You work those things in. And I'm not sure that I've perfected that. I don't think you can necessarily, because each game is different. Each game has its own little story that's not quite like the game past, and it's not like the game that's going to be in a couple of weeks. But there's a delicate balance between stats and color or fill, if you will. And I think that's something that's just kind of a weekly thing that you try your best with each game to get the right balance. And maybe it might be that, you know, one game deserves more numbers than another. And I think that's up to the individual broadcaster to figure that out. Maybe you know that in general, your fan base doesn't want a lot of numbers. Maybe you've gotten feedback. Nowadays, we all get it, right? With Twitter and social media, and everybody's got your cell phone number somehow or your email address. And that's great. I mean, the feedback that we get now compared to the old days is great, because you do find out maybe some things that your audience would like to consume but can't because you're not giving it to them. So you take the good with the bad. But I think that's an individual thing of finding that right balance between the different elements of the broadcast and how much goes into the perfect recipe, if you will.
I know it was your first year at Wake Forest, but can you recount what it was like to broadcast games of a young Tim Duncan?
Well, you know, at the time he was an old Tim Duncan, because, you know, my first year, and it's a great marker for me, because my first year at Wake was Tim Duncan's last year. And I remember leaving Huntington and heading to Winston-Salem. I thought, and some of my friends thought, man, you're going to go walk right into the Final Four your first year. And I just kind of took for granted that Tim Duncan was going to take Wake Forest to the Final Four. And we all know that it's not as easy to get to a Final Four as maybe a young person might think. But that was a great start. You know, Wake Forest had come off of a couple of ACC titles. Dave Odom was the coach. And Tim Duncan was obviously the cornerstone of those teams. And Tim was, as a senior, I think probably was as unchanged the year he retired from the Spurs. He was just the same every week, every year. And, you know, Tim didn't come back to Wake Forest a whole lot, but the times he was back, he was always the same. He never changed. And that's one of the things about Tim Duncan that I'll always remember and appreciate. I mean, you could make the argument that he's one of the top five, six players to ever play the game, certainly at his position. And yet he was just the same guy. And a lot of people it would have affected differently than it did Tim. But he was certainly a great player and just was so effortless with what he could do with a basketball. His bank shots to me still, you just don't see that skill much anymore. But he perfected that. And that's certainly one of the arsenals in his repertoire that made him so, so good for so, so long. But yeah, that's an easy marker for him, for me, you know, getting to come in and actually witness the great Tim Duncan. He was something to watch.
Same question from a Chris Paul perspective, because you get to watch, and that's a little bit of a different one because of what he means to Winston-Salem as a community, and I guess vice versa.
Yeah, Chris was incredible story, as we all know, and just a great player and a really, really good person. You know, his family's still here. His mom and dad still come to a lot of Wake Forest games, and they've been great over the years. And you know, Chris has done so much for this community in terms of giving back. He gives back with his money. He gives back with his time, and he certainly is revered in these parts. And I, my color commentator Mark Freidinger, is a scout for the Spurs and has been for a long time, and so he's got this unbelievable ability to see potential in players. And, you know, Chris played a couple of years at Wake before he went to the NBA. And, you know, we could all see that Chris Paul was really, really good. I didn't see in him what my analyst did, Mark did. He said, oh, he's going to be a great, great pro. And it's like, okay, I'll take your word for it. And obviously he ended up being a great pro and is a great pro. But he was a special talent. Looking back on it now, I was like, how could you not see that? I remember, I know I did not see Chris play in high school. He played at West Forsyth High School, which, as I sit here with you, it's about 10 minutes from my house. And I never saw him play in high school. And I remember The summer before his freshman year, I stopped by the practice gym over on campus, and there was this little kid out there just, against some of our returning veterans. Just incredible. I was like, who in the world is this kid? And one of our players came over and I said, who is that out there? He said, it's Chris Paul. Oh, okay. Okay. And so I really got excited about and glad of the fact that Chris Paul was ours, right? He was going to be a weight guy. And yeah, he was something to watch and obviously a great college player. And as again, Mark Freidinger knew, he was going to be the real deal in the NBA as well, but it's always great to see Chris. And he too, when you consider the celebrity that he has now, with all the television commercials and all those types of things that Tim Duncan does not have and doesn't want. But Chris is the same. He just is. And that's refreshing to be around Chris when he's back and he treats you just like he did when he was a freshman or a sophomore in college. That's good.
What's it like to have an analyst that's an active scout?
It's great.
Like I know we're working with people that have knowledge, but that's a unique knowledge base or knowledge well to have sitting next to you.
Yeah, this was, and again, his name is Mark Freidinger. We just call him Dinger. And this was his 34th year on the radio. It's my 28th at Wake, his 34th. And he was a head coach at Rollins College. He, as a matter of fact, was on the Kansas team in the late 80s with Danny Manning. He was an assistant there with Coach Popovich under Larry Brown. And so and Mark was also an assistant coach at Wake Forest for a time. So Mark has taught me more about the game of basketball over the last 28 years. I just, it's been an unbelievable, and he's a great communicator too. He really has an ability, and I think that's why he's lasted so long on the radio and has been as successful as he's been. He's got this really incredible talent of taking the complex, the X's and O's of basketball, and kind of dumbing them down, if you will, certainly for me, and for your average fan, of explaining the game in a way that they can really, get their head around it and their arms around it and understand what's going on. Does it with a lot of emotion. He loves basketball. It's a huge part of his life, obviously. And he's just been the best partner. I can't imagine what my 28 years here at Wake would have been without Mark. And he, this past year, he battled a lot of health issues to be with us. He didn't travel, but he still did the road games from his home. We hooked him up, connected him with me from the studio, and then just worked off my description of the games. He didn't even watch them. That's how good he is in understanding the game of basketball, that he could go off my description of the game, and he knew exactly.
No pressure, by the way. Yeah,
exactly. I was like, Mark, you really, let's sync up the TV. No, I don't want to do that. So, and I don't know of anybody else in the country that's doing that. And we never did try to fool people. We were always upfront about, Mark's health and the hurdles he was facing this past year. But it's been an incredible luxury to have him as an analyst. I can promise you that.
What is it like to call a game with a person you can't see and who can't see the game?
A lot of people have asked that. And when you've been around each other for almost 30 years, it's like an old married couple. He knows by the way I describe what's going on, what's actually going on. And again, I'm sure I missed a whole lot of detail, even though I've been doing it a long time. I'm not perfect. And don't claim to know a tenth of what Mark does with regard to the game of basketball. And so he could tell by the way I was describing, and he knows my cadence, he knows my rhythms and all those types of things. So he would know when to interject and when to lay out and all those types of things. But it, there is some difficulty there that we had to get used to in the early stages of this year. And I would prompt him with more questions than I might when he was beside me at home games. So it was a little bit of a process, but it didn't take us too long. And I promise you, Joel, if you didn't know on the road games that he was not there with me, you wouldn't know unless we told you. He was that good. And we'll see what happens next year. But it went pretty well this year for an unorthodox way of doing it. I thought it went pretty well.
That's awesome. Why do you do this? What motivates
Well, it beats working for a living,
you?
that's for sure. I kind of fell backward into this. I mean, if the book I will never write, if I did write it, the title would be all I ever wanted to do was play. I was a player, or I thought I was. I wanted to play college football and maybe have a crack at the NFL. Now that's a huge dream, but a good buddy of mine did exactly that. We played high school football together. Bill Bates played for the Dallas Cowboys for 15 years. And he stood up with me at my wedding. We kind of shared the same type of goal. And, his lifelong dream worked out. Mine didn't. So when a right knee of mine didn't cooperate, okay, what do you do? My kind of fallback plan was to maybe go into medicine. Both my high school, or rather both my college roommates, are doctors today. But that last year of mine in high school, when I couldn't play with a knee issue, worked with the local radio station to do some things, did some interviews that they liked, and ended up, while I went to school at Tennessee, worked as a part-time guy at the radio station for a while. And then just when my high school football coach, Ken Sparks, went from Farragut High School to Carson Newman, I was working at the radio station in Knoxville. Hey, would you like to call our games? When I did the first one, I was hooked. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And then that's when all those years of listening to John Ward started to pay off, because, as a younger person, I really didn't have working in radio or TV necessarily as a goal, but I listened to games. I watched games on television. I watched a lot of movies. I really enjoyed media, just as anybody else might, maybe more so than some. But once I got into media, it was, all those years of watching and listening, and in a way preparing, not knowing that I was preparing. And I remember before the first broadcast that I ever did of a Carson Newman game, I asked John Ward, and now the voice of the Vols, Bob Kessling, who was spotting for John back at the time and who hired me at the radio station in Knoxville, can I just hang out in the Vol Network booth? Because I got to do a broadcast next week at Carson Newman Football. I've never been in a broadcast booth. I have no idea what I'm doing. And they said, sure. That happened to be the opening game of 1980, the first game for a guy by the name of Herschel Walker at the University of Georgia. Georgia visited Tennessee. It was a close game. I don't think either team had done a whole lot at halftime. And in the second half, the head coach at the time, the Georgia Bulldogs, brought out this freshman by the name of Herschel Walker. And the legend of Herschel Walker began. That was the first time I had ever been in a broadcast booth. The next week, I was in my own, working as part of the broadcast team at Carson Newman. So, some of these things are crazy, but that's kind of how that all shook out a long, long time ago now.
One question I always love to ask people is, what's one thing you need to be successful on the air every night? And that can be, I've got to do this ahead of time. I've got to check this ahead of time. I need this written somewhere ahead of time. What's a big key for you to be successful any given broadcast?
That is a great question. And I think it goes back to being a player and being well coached when I was playing. And I had some great youth coaches, whether it be Little League or football, and into high school. Obviously, playing for Ken Sparks, he would go on, he's still in top 10 college wins of all time. Just being ready, and not, it was kind of, I remember I took Latin in high school, and you know, that was a tough class. And our Latin teacher told me, her name was Ms. Edgel. And she told me in our class one day, you know, look, you need to prepare for this exam, but just, you know, you can only do so much work. And, you know, the day before, you if you're ready, you're ready. If you're not, you're not. You know, cramming is not going to get it done. And so what I try to do is be ready a day ahead of time, basically, in a general kind of a way. And that's, you know, and I probably not a day goes by that I don't do something ahead of a football game or a basketball game to try and get ready. But about 24 hours out, my charts are done. I've watched a lot of tape. I've been to practice, and I'm kind of ready. And I take that 24 hour period just to kind of relax, slow the heart rate down. So one of the great things about broadcasting for me, and you ask, why do I do it? It's the next best thing to playing for me. And so growing up as an athlete and trying to always be prepared ahead of the game, it's kind of that, again, just being ready and not having to cram at the last minute. Either you're ready or you're not. And so like on a football broadcast by Friday night, kind of like studying for that Latin exam, I'm done. I've done all the homework I can do. I'm ready to go. Now let's slow down your heart rate, just like, you know, you're getting ready to play a game. Relax, so that you can enjoy the game, enjoy the broadcast. So I try to relate it back to playing. And that's worked well for me over the years, because it's one thing I always try to tell myself as the game goes along: slow down, relax. You know, let it's kind of cliche, but let the game come to you. You know, and it's worked.
I want to branch off of what you just said, though. When it comes to slowing your heart rate down and just being able to enjoy the game, feel like, especially in big moments, that can be one of the hard things for broadcasters to do. And maybe that goes back to being a player originally first, for you, being able to kind of slow things down as you see it. How do you live in the moment, know when something big is about to happen, and settle yourself down and be able to attack it kind of as an artist and as a craftsman of what we do?
Well, certainly having done it for 44 years helps.
That helps too. Yeah.
yeah. You know, it's, but I really think it's critical to be as effective as you can be to have that kind of approach. And the way I do it is every commercial break, it's for whatever reason, I've just kind of conditioned myself. And sometimes I don't get it right. Sometimes I'm not as slow as I need to be. And so I don't think you ever get it right. I don't think you can ever perfect it. But during each commercial break, it's just the way I've kind of conditioned myself. Make sure you slow down. Make sure you don't just, you know, in a football game, for instance, zone in on the ball and forget about all the other surroundings. Because I think that, you know, as you paint that picture, there's an awful lot of detail that you can miss if you're just kind of zoning in on the ball, the play, even though the game's the most important thing, to paint that total picture. You know, you've got your help from your analyst, your sideline reporter, and everything else. But it's let's try to see the play, yes, but see the whole deal as well. Because in the end, if you can deliver that to that person driving down the road in the car, then without even knowing it, they're there. They feel like they're at the game. And when they're talking to their buddies about the game, they feel like they were there. And if you can get at least part of that, then you've done your job. But it's, Joel, it's hard. It's hard to do. And you know, as I go back and listen to games, sometimes I go, you know, I wasn't as in the moment as I need to be, or the moment was, it was so crazy and maybe unexpected, like a blocked field goal, something like that, to win a game. I remember when Wake Forest won the 2006 ACC championship early in the year. There was a game with Duke in Winston-Salem. It came down to Duke had the ball last, got in front of the upper. It was basically an extra point. And you just kind of, you know, all of us, you know, sometimes you fall into that, well, the game's over. You know, they're going to hit this field goal and that's it. Well, Wake had a guy go in, block the field goal, won the game. And weeks later, Wake doesn't have an opportunity to go to the ACC title game if they had not won that game. And so I remember being disappointed in myself because I almost was at the point of just assuming that that field goal, which was basically an extra point, was going to go in and Wake was going to lose the game. Didn't happen. And so I think it takes a jolt or two like that for you to say, you know, never take anything for granted. Always approach every game of what am I going to see today? And each play, really, if you can, what's going to happen here? Always be ready for the unexpected. And that just takes time. You know, it takes, you know, getting knocked off the bike and back on. And I don't care if you've been doing it 10, 20, 30 years, it'll get you. You know, you'll miss some opportunity. And people may not notice it. But I think if you're in tune to what you're doing and you are willing to be self-critical and go back and watch or listen to something you're doing and say, you know what, I could have been better. I'll be better prepared next time. I think, you know, that's a good exercise always to try and be that way. And I've tried to do that. I'm not perfect. None of us is perfect. So even though I'm old and been doing it a long time, I try to go back and learn something every week. I mean, I think that's the only way to approach it, really.
You also mentioned watching film as you get yourself ready every week. Particularly in a football sense, because that was your playing background. What do you watch for that helps you most as a play-by-play broadcaster? We'll leave it there. What do you watch that helps you most in your role the way you see the game now?
You know, it's just really, I try to get my football charts, if we're going to stick with football, I try to get those done as soon as I can. I mean, I start on those on a Sunday, and a lot of times by Monday morning, I have at least the nuts and bolts of that, at least the players, you know, the two and three deeps down. And then I can start watching a game and matching what I'm watching with what I'm seeing on my board. Is somebody in the game that's not necessarily on a two or three deep, I'll make that note and put him here, you know, or somewhere. And then it's a process of, you know, filling out the stats and the personal notes, things like that throughout the week, continuing to watch maybe that same game over, maybe a second game or a parts of a second game or a third game, and just matching it with what you have on your board. Sometimes you can't avoid it, but what you don't want is a whole lot of who is that? Where did he come from? And sometimes that just happens. You know, a player or two gets injured in practice during the week of your opponent. You don't know it. That's just kind of the daily process of working through that and trying to minimize the surprises on game day. That's what I'm kind of trying to do.
How much do you look at things through the former player's lens? And how does that influence you as a player?
You know, a little bit. I played in high school, right? And it's not like I had this, all pro career, you know, in football. So, you know, but I played everything. You know, I played basketball and played baseball and football and golf and tennis and all that kind of stuff. So at least there's some kind of foundation of, you know what, maybe not like these guys are, but I've kind of been there, played basketball. I've been out there on the court, have been coached, understand the basics of the game and what you're trying to get done. So, you know, and I think you always, at least I've kind of, I feel like I'm 17, 18 right now, although when I look in the mirror, I know I'm not. But, and you remember what it was like to play. You remember what it was like to prepare in practice. And so at least to a certain extent, you know what those players are going through. And so you can, you know, I think it's easier to look at it through that lens when you have played at least some compared to others maybe who never played at all. And that doesn't mean you can't be a great play-by-play announcer. Right? And just because you've played at some level doesn't make you a good one. And just because you haven't doesn't make you a bad one. There's no correlation that I can see necessarily to that. But yeah, I always look at things kind of, you know, as a former quarterback and, you know, on offense, trying to see the whole field and this, that, and the other. Yeah, I think we all kind of fall back to what we know and use those around us to help fill in the gaps of what we don't know. And with me, that's been a lot of gaps over the years.
Last question for you, and this might be hard over the course of a 40-year career, but is there a call that you've made in your time that resonates with you most, that you remember the most, that you're a fan of the most? And maybe it has nothing to do with the play that you called, but like when you look back, you're like, I crushed that one, and this is why. And I don't mean that in like a self-congratulatory way, but like when you look at the craft and just say, you know what, this moment, that was a great night because everything aligned and we did the best for our listeners.
It's a really good question. And I'm not sure that I can pinpoint a moment necessarily or a play. And I'll be honest with you. I think if you have enough skill, you ought to be able to hit the big moments, right? It's when I look back, when I go back on a weekly basis and listen to games, it's more of in a stretch, you know, like, did we do our jobs of in that quarter telling the story? Did we use all the resources that we had in front of us that we prepared with, that we talked about trying to get points across? Were we able to do that? So I probably going to disappoint you with not having
that's a great answer. Yeah.
Moment. But taking pride in, you know what, that was a good broadcast, listening back to it and say, you know what, maybe it wasn't for a conference championship or whatever, but for the fans, you know, those games are important. I don't care if it's a regular season game or whatever. It might be with a rival or whatnot. But, you know, there are certain iconic moments that I'll never forget. That the first of five national championships when I was at Carson Newman was in 1983. And, you know, I've talked about today the emotional attachment I had to my time at Carson Newman. And still to this day, I have a soft spot in my heart, not just for Carson Newman, but for Marshall too. My 4 years at Marshall were four of the greatest years of my life. They really, really were. But that first national championship at Carson Newman, we had talked about, and when I mean we, Ken Sparks and his program, all of us had talked about, this is where we want to take this Carson Newman program to a national title contender. And winning that first one, it was in Colorado. It was a snowy, icy day. And it just kind of felt like Christmas when that game was over. And that's what I said at the end of the game. It's Christmas in Colorado, because it just felt that way. You know, we all know what it, for those of us who celebrate Christmas, we know what it's like on Christmas morning. That celebration and opening of the gifts and all that. My first year at Marshall, they won the 1AA national championship. And it was, for people who know the history of Marshall, the horrible plane crash of 1970. And living in that community for just, again, I had only been there, you know, 2.5, 3 months, whatever it was, prior to that game. But already knowing what that community had gone through and the emotion of that tragedy, and going from there in 1970 to winning a national title in 1992 and being a part of that emotional week, I'll never forget. And I still get chill bumps thinking about when that clock wound down with Youngstown State and Marshall won a national title. That was pretty special. Just saying those words, Marshall has won the national championship, that was pretty special. And you know, in 2006 here at Wake Forest, that year the football team was picked to finish last in the ACC, played for an ACC title, won it over Georgia Tech, and then played in the Orange Bowl for a team that wasn't supposed to do anything. That was a very special moment. I'll never forget that. So, you know, there are moments, certainly, but for me, it's more of, you know, did we get it done over the course of a game? Did we tell the story like we were supposed to do? And when you do that, it's pretty satisfying. It keeps you going to that next week.
Stan, I appreciate you taking the time and for being a guest on the pod. If people want to find more of Stan Cotton or the Wake Forest Demon Deacons, how do they track you down?
I'm on Twitter as little as possible. you know, there are good things and bad things about social media, but they can find me at Stan Cotton. That's with an E, at Stan Cotton WF. And we try to promote what we do on the Wake Forest Sports Network there. And folks can find as much as they want right there.